The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Donna Gerson, and I'm co-chair of the George S. Pepper Society Council and a Free Library Foundation board member. Now it is my great pleasure to introduce Amy Gutman and Jonathan Moreno. Dr. Gutman is the president of the University of Pennsylvania, as well as the longest-serving president in the institution's history, where she is the Christopher H. Brown Distinguished Professor of Political Science and a professor of communication in the Annenberg School. You can, like, clap. I could hear something. And Dr. Moreno, her colleague at Penn, is the David and Lynn Silfen University professor and a widely sought-after expert on bioethics, having served as an advisor to three presidential commissions, the Centers for Disease Control, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to name just a few. Doctors Gutman and Moreno spent 7 years together on Barack Obama's Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. Their new book, Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, But Nobody Wants to Die, is a sweeping consideration of the ethical, social, and political questions surrounding healthcare in the United States today. Tonight, they'll be joined in conversation by award-winning journalist and Philadelphia favorite Jim Gardner, anchor of 6ABC's Action News for 4 decades. So please join me in welcoming Amy Gutman and Jonathan Moreno to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. We have a good crowd. That's terrific.
I'm always worried that I'll come in and there'll be nobody in the audience. Wow.
Just so it doesn't seem like I'm being disrespectful, I asked Drs. Moreno and Gutman before, how should I refer to them? I mean, these are eminent scholars. And I was told Amy and Jonathan. So that's what I'm going to do. Although once we get backstage again, it'll be Dr. Gutman and Dr. Moreno. First of all, thank you so much for allowing me to take part in this. It is flattering and humbling, and I appreciate it so much. And not the least of which, it gave me an opportunity to read this book, which, left to my own devices, I might not have read. I love reading about politics and a novel here and there, so I might not have. But it taught me so much. Put things into a fascinating perspective, and I think it's just a great opportunity to bring this book alive a little bit to the folks who are here, as this book has gone into the bookstores and is now proudly displayed at the University of Pennsylvania bookstore and in every university bookstore in America. So that's terrific. But I think we should start off at the beginning. Sometime in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there was a dramatic transformation, and I heard the video refer to this just a little bit from backstage, a dramatic transformation of the relationship between doctor and patient. Before this transformation took place, it was a paternalistic relationship, almost a reverential relationship. The doctor had almost complete power in that relationship. And then it transformed to a situation where we heard phrases like, duty to tell. Explain that transformation, if you would, and how that transformation gave rise to the field of bioethics.
Sure. So first of all, thank you, Jim Gardner. And let's thank Jim Gardner for he was just on the air. Thank you so much. And thank all of you for being here. This was really a labor of love, and love has something to do with the answer to your question, because we both tell personal stories at the beginning of the book, and we actually bonded over these stories, which is a little strange because you'll see both of these stories are about something that isn't very happy, but it did inform us about why everybody is so concerned about and so interested in healthcare, because it affects all of our lives, and we also have some really hard choices in our life to make, and they're really consequential choices. And so the first one, which I tell, then I'll hand it over to you, Jonathan, to tell yours. The first one that I tell in the book is about, I was about 10 years old, I'm visiting my grandma in my grandma Eva in Long Island City Housing Project with my mom. And I opened the door to her little apartment, and instead of the wonderful smell of cookies coming out, there's a really horrible smell. Turns out my next thing we know, my mother's calling the ambulance, and we're in the emergency room because my grandma has gangrene. Her whole right leg was swollen. And the doctor comes out and asks my mother for permission to amputate my grandma's leg. And my mother, who had no college education but was really street smart, said, "Why are you asking me? You have to ask her for her permission." And that was paternalism. It was doctor knows best medicine. I had a wonderful pediatrician who carried that black bag, and he was wonderful. He recommended college to me, but I really found out later in life that that black bag was a mixed bag. And so why don't you tell your story?
So, and both of these stories are really ways of backgrounding how the doctor-patient relationship has changed. So when I was 6 years old, my mother was diagnosed with a chondrosarcoma in her right shoulder. She was young, she was 39 years old. And when she was in Memorial Hospital in New York, it wasn't her doctor who came into the room to give her diagnosis. It was her husband, my dad, who was a physician. This is how the way things were done in those days. The brother physician got to tell his wife the news. Then radiation therapy didn't work. Nothing worked. So she had a life-saving amputation at the clavicle. And when she was self-rehabilitating, which is pretty much the way it went in those days, in the late 1950s, she was looking for something in the night table, in the drawer next to their bed and my father's side, and she pulled out the drawer and she saw this crumpled up piece of paper that was on her surgeon's stationery. And it said, "Dear Dr. Moreno, as we discussed, if your wife survives 5 years, she will consider her cured." That prognosis conversation is not one that she had ever had with her surgeon. Although she loved her surgeon, it was something that she resented.
So it was this transformation that gave rise to bioethics. What are bioethics, and what was it about this transformation that produced it?
Yeah, yeah. Why don't you go?
Well, the bioethics is the study of human values in medicine and the life sciences. There's always been a long tradition, of course, in the Hippocratic days of medical ethics, but it was doctor ethics. And as the institutions started being challenged in the 1960s, and some of us are old enough to remember that period, the Watergate Vietnam era, medicine was also being challenged, partly through some scandals we can talk about. And so people started coming forward, physicians, philosophers, theologians, lawyers, and nurses, and said, you know, the old doctor-oriented medical ethics has to recognize that the world is changing. People are now insisting on being part of their medical decision-making. And that was a quiet revolution that played itself out in the 60s and 70s and actually continues to this day.
Yeah, and our choices just became so many more. It was at the same time that medicine became infinitely more powerful, that its actual, the status of doctors plummeted, the trust in doctors plummeted from over 70% of trust in doctors in the medical profession in the early 60s to just above 30% now. It's above journalists, but it's still...
Most journalists.
Right. But seriously, we see that connected to, as Jonathan, you like to say, it's like kitchen table conversation is what bioethics is to medicine, because we all, it's connected to the fact that we need to take control over our own healthcare individually and those, you know, and collectively we need to take control over the healthcare of our society because those choices affect us. And if we don't do it, we know that there are other people who will do it for us, pharmaceuticals and so on. So I think it's a good thing that we've gone from blind trust to earned trust.
You make some fascinating points in the book that Vietnam and Watergate compromise people's trust in institutions and authoritative institutions, so that medicine was also an authoritative institution, and that compromised people's the way they viewed doctors. There may not be a direct link, but it's collateral damage in the whole Watergate and Vietnam situation. Let's try to pick up some speed because there are a lot of things we want to cover here. I don't mean to be impertinent. Obviously,
that's always a bad preface. It's a good preface to a hard question. Okay, here we go.
And obviously, I don't want to sound that way. But don't you have enough to do running one of the esteemed universities in the world? How do you have time to write? Why did you write this book?
Well, first of all, it's a passion. Running the University of Pennsylvania is a calling, and it's a calling connected to the love of learning. Part of the greatness of our university is that we bring what are called the eds and meds together. We have a phenomenal health system, and we run, you know, phenomenal hospitals. And for the last four decades of my life, I've been interested in the relationship of Americans to our own healthcare and our healthcare system. And so it was really, it was a calling, and it rose to even a higher level when President Obama asked me to chair his bioethics commission, asked Jonathan to be its senior advisor before I knew Jonathan well at all. And I used to say, when the president asks you to do something, you should do it. I can't say that anymore.
So you devote...
When my president asks me to do something, I do
it. Yeah. You devote a very substantial portion of the book to the controversy surrounding healthcare. Very much top-of-the-mind stuff. And perhaps this quote from the book explains why. You say, healthcare is a human right because without it, we lack the capacity and fair equality of opportunity to enjoy everything else in life. And then you go on to ask, why does the U.S. spend twice as much on medical care as other affluent countries, but provide health insurance to the lowest proportion of the population?
I mean, this is part of the story of developing inequality for the last 40 or 50 years. Healthcare costs have risen, so there have been some attempts, in particular Obamacare, to at least manage access, but costs still a problem, a growing problem, and it's exacerbating the problems that middle-class people have in keeping up. And we've seen the consequences of that throughout our political system. It's serious business. The economists have pointed out for 30 years that we're on an absolute collision course with the rise of GDP and as a percentage, proportion of healthcare as a proportion of GDP, and it's unsustainable. And at the same time, there is a moral obligation on affluent society not to give people a handout, as we used to say, but to help people have the opportunities to enjoy the fruits of such a country.
Yeah, so healthcare is an essential enabler, just like education is. And without healthcare, you can't enjoy education either, right? So healthcare is so fundamental. And we get something so right in this country, which is the innovation part of healthcare. And all those choices that are out there, the good choices, are we can credit the amazing entrepreneurial zeal, the amazing quest for knowledge of our society. However, we don't get the cost or the access equation at all right. And the strange thing about it is that if we got one right, the other, we could get the other right too. So if we did better in access, we could do better in controlling costs, and vice versa. If we did better in controlling costs, we could expand access. So we show that in the book, and that's part of the reason for the title. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Everybody wants everything that's good about healthcare, but we don't want to face the questions of those things that are not good for us, like all those opioids, or the need to control costs so we can make it more accessible to people. And we're not good at that in this country, and yet I think now there's an opportunity to be good at it because more and more Americans are putting healthcare at the top as the most important issue for them.
It's pretty clear that our government is having a tough time agreeing on what's best for healthcare reform, and you say in the book, the justice of American healthcare reaches far beyond medical matters to the very political and socioeconomic structure of our society. National healthcare reform is at the epicenter of American political polarization. As long as we are polarized as we are, is it fruitless to think that we're going to come to some kind of a resolution on this healthcare debate?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think the polarization has gotten to the point where every poll and every focus group shows that the vast majority of Americans are not polarized the way our politicians are. The vast majority of Americans really want basic health care, and they really want drug prices to be controlled, and we can do it.
Is it the bioethicist's role to get involved in the political choices of the day, Medicare for all, Medicare for some, public option? Is there a role for the ethicist in that debate?
Well, the people in bioethics have the role of assessing the arguments about what is appropriate access to healthcare in a liberal democratic society, and have been doing that for a long time. Even in the early 1980s, a presidential bioethics commission under President Reagan came to a consensus that there is a diverse moral obligation to provide a decent minimum level of health care. They didn't use the word right to health care, and that's been the shift over the last 30 years. We believe that there is a human right to health care.
Okay, but so Romney Care in Massachusetts is accepted, it's successful, it's popular. Obamacare, which is virtually identical, has always been mired in controversy and opposition. What's the difference?
So the biggest difference is Romney Care was passed by a bipartisan coalition, and the Affordable Care Act, as you'll recall, not a single Republican voted for it. So there was a huge incentive for one party to continue to campaign against it. And I think you all know the repeal and replace campaign and what the fate of it is. You can see right now there's been no replacement. What we really want is for the American people to take ownership of this and wrest it out of the hands of Washington, where it's not doing well. Now, the good news is the Affordable Care Act has managed to cover 90% of the population. The bad news is it's trickling down as it's being chipped away, and cost controls aren't there. By the way, the Affordable Care Act did more to cover costs than Romney Care did, but again, because Romney Care was bipartisan, everybody in the political side rallied to try to fix it, and Washington, if you haven't noticed, is dysfunctional. So the way it's going to become functional on healthcare, I don't know that we're going to make it functional generally speaking, but on healthcare, the reason that I believe it will function on this very important issue is that the American people rank healthcare as the most important issue for them, and the two things they care about are being covered and bringing costs under control. And when you cover more people and bring costs under control, the 90% who are covered are going to benefit too, because nobody wants to have insulin unaffordable when opioids are, you know, flooding our streets and killing people, and the lack of insulin is also killing people, and all you have to do is make insulin affordable and start controlling the opioids. I mean, that's not all you have to do, but you can at least start there. You could start there.
So in about the year 2000, bioethicists started looking more into the areas of public health than the individual doctor-patient relationship, and that brought into view a whole slew of issues and controversies, and let's go through some of them. So what's the origin of the vaccine causes autism thing?
It's really wonderful to hear you all say that because you all realize that it was a terrible lengthy episode in preventing something that is so preventable from happening, which is getting rid forever of measles, of polio, of rubella. I mean, here's what happened, just in a nutshell. The Lancet published an article by a doctor named Andrew Wakefield, which was the single most damaging article ever published in a medical journal. It turned out, unbeknownst to Lancet, that it claimed that autism was linked to the MMR vaccine. Measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. It claimed that on the basis of interviews with 12 parents, the recollection of 12 parents. It turned out, if you don't think that was bad enough, the evidence was fraudulent. And it turned out Andrew Wakefield had an interest, a financial interest, in a single measles vaccine. He's still around, actually, egging the anti-vaxxers on. It's been shown to be totally fraudulent, and this just shows that while you shouldn't have blind trust in expertise, you should not dismiss expertise after it's been tested by over 1,000 studies have now shown that these vaccines are safe.
So after the anthrax, or after 9/11,
yeah.
After 9/11, and we've talked before, this was one of the most challenging and interesting things in the entire book for me. So back right after 9/11, there was the anthrax scare. Do people remember that? 5 people were actually killed in the anthrax scare. And someone came up with the idea, well, we need to test the anthrax vaccine on children because we don't know how they're going to respond in the possible case that we're going to have a massive anthrax scare. So the question then arose, well, do we put children at risk for something that we don't really know and we don't think is going to happen, but if it does, then you're prepared. I thought that was a fascinating conundrum, and how do you solve it?
Before Amy tells the substantive story, I have to say a little bit of background as the senior advisor. Having hung around Washington a bit, when I don't know who it was who first said to me that the White House might ask the commission to figure out how to solve this problem, as the advisor, my first reaction was, oh, please, let's do something else. You know, please ask the commission. This is hard, right? And they're smart. I know the commissioners are good. But nonetheless, I'd like something that I could get my arms around. Well, they took it on, you know, regardless of me. And actually, it went out very well, but you should tell that story.
So we were asked by the president and the secretary of HHS, who was Kathleen Sebelius at the time, to advise, give them a recommendation on what to do. They had gotten a recommendation from the national defense healthcare sector to start testing anthrax on children. And the first thing I did say to my commission members is, okay, you put anthrax vaccine and children together, this is the assignment from hell, right? So how are we going to make heaven out of hell? Well, we had these open hearings and we heard, please, we have to do it. And then there were representatives of parents and pediatricians who said, and we looked at the regs, and the regs quite rightly say, and this is after the, you know, Nuremberg, decades after Nuremberg, they say, if a child or a vulnerable subject doesn't stand to benefit from a medical experiment, you cannot impose more than minimal risk on them. To do otherwise is actually to use individuals as guinea pigs. Kant would say to use people as means only, not as ends in themselves. But it's perfectly summarized by saying don't use human beings as guinea pigs. So how did we solve this conundrum? Well, actually, we have scientists and doctors on the commission, and we spoke to them as well as philosophers, and we came up with a tried and true method, which nobody had suggested to us until we had these hearings. And that is, first test the adult vaccine at the lowest dose that's known to be effective on the youngest adults, 18 to 20-year-olds. If you find that safe, then you take 16 to 18-year-olds, and it's safe for them, you can extrapolate, and just do age de-escalation. And you've got the way, the ethical way of actually protecting children. And I'd never seen Kathleen Sebelius and Barack Obama smile so widely when they got this recommendation. And it was all through public deliberations. So we're a big believer in bringing ethicists and scientists together with public, the public who shares their concerns in trying to solve problems like this.
There is no better example of tensions that bioethicists study than those that pervade experimental science. And then you go on to talk about, and it's a phrase that I've never heard before, moral science. When you say the goal of maximizing welfare should not override respect for human rights. Yeah. Talk to me about Tuskegee, and talk to me about the Nuremberg Code.
Well, yeah. This goes back to the previous conversation about the collapse of respect or trust in institutions. The syphilis study was going on for 40 years when it was not secret. There were citations to the syphilis study in dermatology textbooks, the Tuskegee syphilis study, which really should be called, I say this to my students pedantically, I would call it the U.S. Public Health Service syphilis study, because it was the U.S. Public Health Service that was doing it for 40 years. I think this was like the atom bomb in bioethics. It happened that the civil rights movement had been going on. You had the Attica prison riot. Right, it happened. There are these.
I'm not sure everybody here is familiar with Tuskegee study.
The syphilis study involved about 400 African American men who were sharecroppers who had syphilis, and syphilis was pandemic at that time in this region, in this area. And so it was actually partly a eugenic study because there had been a study of syphilis in men in Norway, and the notion was perhaps this disease. This is the eugenic era. Perhaps this disease progresses differently in the Negro male, quote unquote. So this was an observational study, but it was also a highly deceptive study. The men weren't told they had syphilis. They were told they had bad blood. When they could have been drafted for World War II, they were kept out of the draft. They weren't given penicillin in the 1950s when it was largely available. So it was a shock to the system. And it seemed to many people that even the medical system, the public health system was shot through with racism, as was the case with so many other institutions.
And it not only seemed, it was. I mean, 40 years, 600 subjects, 400 of them had syphilis. We had a cure for syphilis and penicillin, and they weren't told about it. So that was just a huge shock. And the Nuremberg Codes had come out in the late 40s, and as we tell in the book, Jay Katz, who's a dear friend, said his American medical students said, oh, that's a good code for barbarians, but nothing like that could happen here. Not only, I mean, not that it was the same as, nothing was the same as the Nazi doctors, but the first line of the Nuremberg Code is that the voluntary consent of human subjects is absolutely essential. And there were one after another of these huge studies going on, not only in Tuskegee, the Tuskegee one was a huge bombshell, but in my, you know, birth city of Brooklyn, New York, there was the Brooklyn Chronic Disease Hospital case where cancer cells were injected in, you know, elderly, demented patients. Couldn't help them at all. It wasn't live, you know, it couldn't give them cancer either, but they were not informed of it at all. So this is an era where, you know, the doctor knows best era, where patients still had not yet been empowered to assert their human rights.
So let's bring it to the current era. Is there medical research or scientific research being done that is biased against underserved communities? Is this still an issue, not like Tuskegee, but in a current iteration?
Yeah, it is still an issue. It's not like Tuskegee in the Brooklyn and the Guatemala case, which is also in the book, all of which done under the auspices of the government or paid for by the government. But what's happening now, which is that we don't do good experiments on women. It's almost a flip that now that we actually are abiding by people's rights, informing them of what will happen in experiments, not imposing too much risk, but we're learning things about a lot about white men and how you can help them, you know, save them from cardiac arrest, save them from cancer, and so on. We're not doing enough with women and minority populations to learn how to treat them well, because it's not as, I needn't tell this audience, we're not biologically precisely constituted the same, and there are genetically related diseases that affect, for example, Ashkenazi Jewish populations, African American populations, and it's only been recently that these issues have come up, and again, it's the American public and patients asserting themselves that's going to make medicine more ethical moving forward. It's much more ethical than it used to be, but it's got still, as they say, as feminists say, we have a long way to go, right?
And there's a, back to the public health point, as well as the experiments point. I'm particularly interested in sickle cell. So here you have a historically underserved population of the public health system has failed, particularly if you talk to people who take care of sickle cell patients, this transition when you turn 18 from pediatric care to adult care for sickle cell is really not well done. We're not getting people the basic what medical care is available. At the same time, there are more than a dozen clinical trials of sickle cell involving CRISPR, which we can talk more about, the latest form of genetic engineering, you might say. So we have this kind of weird paradox, right, that we're not getting the basic stuff to people, but we are spending appropriately, as we should be, money on high-end experiments that might someday end up curing sickle cell.
All right, let's speed this up a little bit because I do want to get to all of this. Can we talk about death for a second?
Sure.
I know. When you're talking about medical research and scientific research,
speed it up, right?
It's hard to avoid.
Let's not speed up death.
Let's not speed up death.
No.
So in 1968, Harvard University gave us the standard for death. And it has, I guess, survive the test of time. It is particularly, it's important for a lot of reasons, but in the area of organ transplantation, the standard for death really sets the whole course. What is the standard for death and how is it so important?
So there came a medical / ethical decision. If there's ever a decision in medicine that is intricately tied to ethics, it was the standard of brain death, right? It was a decision that was made. It makes good sense, but it's not a decision you can make on pure medical grounds. You have to also make sure it's ethical as well to declare someone dead when their brain dies. Now, the great thing about brain death standard, not brain death, but the brain death standard, is it does permit organs to be still alive and be transplanted. And I'm just going to fast forward so we don't just dwell on the macabre part of it, because there are challenges to the brain death standard, but in our view, it makes good sense. What doesn't work well in this country that we could make even better sense of is getting more organs to be donated. And so we make some suggestions in the book for what we all should think about, since we all want to maximize the possibility of saving our own lives and our families' lives and other people's lives, to get more organs to be available for transplant. But brain death was the standard that first made it possible to do, ethically possible to do organ transplant.
Okay, well, let's talk.
It was a very self-conscious move by this Harvard committee in 68.
Right.
They saw that organ transplants were coming, and it happened that brain death also became measurable around that
time. Now, of course, there have been individuals who have remained alive for years after brain death, so can be a little tricky, but
so well, not,
to your
not
point,
actually, they're no, not actually brain dead. It should be said they're in what are called minimally conscious states, or they're vegetative, not brain dead.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
To your point, increasing the number of organ donations, we can talk about nudging. In my family, when I was a kid, we called it nudging. Your family too, right?
My family.
Okay, and also something called opt in and opt out. Yeah. Can you explain that?
Sure. So what we have in, let's talk about nudging for a second, because it's really at the cutting edge of less high-tech medicine. There's a lot of high-tech medicine. The University of Pennsylvania is at the forefront of CAR-T, but we're also at the forefront of something called behavioral medicine. And what nudging is changing the default option of your choices. You still have the same choice as you had before, but you make it easier to choose the healthier option. So having bike kiosks is a nudge to bicycle, and that's a good thing. When I was, bringing up our daughter and going grocery shopping, I was nudged all, I call it nudging when it's bad, nudged all the time to get sugary candies at the checkout counter, because my daughter, they put the sugary candies at the checkout counter. You can't avoid that. You could still choose not. That's a bad nudge, right? So the good nudges in organs would be to have an organ transplant coordinator in every hospital has shown that it really leads to more organ donations. That has no ethical problems with it whatsoever. And then there's the question of whether we as a society want to have opt out of organ when you get your driver's license rather than opt in. So if we had opt out, we would have thousands of more organs available. Just so you know the factual backdrop to this, every day of the year, 20 people die on organ wait lists. There are about 100,000 people on organ wait lists just in this country. So it could make a huge difference. We think that, again, the American people should take an interest in this, because the life you save may be your own or a loved one's?
Abortion.
That's for you, Jonathan.
He's
looking at you.
One would think that the whole abortion story would be one of the prominent issues that bioethicists deal with, that it would attract your energies and your intellect. Counterintuitively, that's not the case.
Abortion is so politicized that it's really hard to address it in a bioethics class. Since I've been at Penn, I've actually done a lecture on abortion in my big undergrad course once, and I wasn't happy with it. The way that that bioethics addresses abortion-related issues is whenever the human embryo or human reproductive capacity is involved, it's a background controversy. So, for example, in the embryonic stem cell debate, given that there is this deep philosophical difference about what counts as the beginning of life and therefore respect for life and humanness and personhood all have different moral implications, those terms, given all that, how can we find an appropriate resolution that the society can live with? And so that's the way it figures into most bioethical discussion. It's the background that we have to take into account when we're dealing with particular issues about human reproductive materials.
Yeah, so given that I sort of grew up with an interest in bioethics, but as a political philosopher teaching political philosophy, political theory courses, I actually taught an ethics and public policy course for years and years in which abortion featured centrally. And my goal in that course, and I believe it's the goal for democracies, is to get us to be able to understand our differences and be civil about them, rather than to resort to violence. I do think at the root of the abortion controversy, and we discuss it in the book, is a fundamental difference about where human life begins. And reason doesn't point you one way or the other, even though people may feel that it does. I and Jonathan as well feel strongly and it's perfectly reasonable to defend. I'm just saying that we can't knock down the other argument entirely. We will defend a woman's right to choose, period, and that's, that is just, and we'll defend it with reasons. But in a course, I want students on both sides of that debate to understand that you don't have to be an evil person to have the opposite view. That said, if it's true for both sides, you should respect both sides. You shouldn't resort to violence. And we cite Dan Callahan in our book, who's a great, and his wife, Sydney. Dan is he just died, a devout Catholic who said, I would not choose abortion for, myself or my wife. His wife is also a devout Catholic. But I do believe it's consistent to respect the right of women to choose for themselves. And that's a thread that runs through our book, including, the right to die with dignity that Brittany Maynard had, championed.
The beauty of the Dan Callahan story is that his wife is a feminist Catholic. But a pro-life feminist Catholic, and they went around the country having debates and respectful debates with each other.
Let me do some housekeeping. Andy, how much time do we have?
Yeah, we've got 10 minutes until we close the evening, and I'd like to ask.
All right, we've got to get to a couple of things.
We'll do lightning round.
You're being nudged.
All right, lightning round. All right, reproductive technology, real fast.
True.
So reproductive technology, real fast, there is no example that more epitomizes the amazing choices and freedom that new medical technologies have brought, and the law hasn't caught up with it yet.
But many people will have this image in their minds,
yes,
of the rogue scientist who is manipulating embryos in the laboratory to create designer babies, babies who have, are the next Einstein or the next Peyton Manning, this whole concept of creating what
it
is
Jim Gardner,
you want.
Jim.
Sure.
That would be the mistake. But
there is cloning.
So how can you convince people that reproductive technology, or for that matter, synthetic biology, where you're manipulating cells, why should we not be afraid of what may be going on in the laboratory?
I run a bioethics film festival, and this is an advertisement in the spring at Penn. And as Amy says, I propagate the view of the mad scientist, because so many science fiction films are about mad scientists or in league with capitalists. I think that the image of the rogue or mad scientist is part of our modern understanding of science, but this is a way of appreciating the power of science. And I have to say that my science colleagues are more and more interested in bioethics.
But let me just say, because we are in Philadelphia here, and why it's so important, Jim, your question is so important, because if that is the first and the last thing you think about, it's such a mistake for ourselves and our society. So we always think of Emily Whitehead, okay, who was 7 years ago, she was 7 years old, and only child of Tom and Carrie Whitehead, and she was dying of ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. All the regular treatments had failed. So her parents looked for an experimental treatment, CAR T cell therapy, cutting edge technology, takes your own cells, re-engineers them, so it's like SynBio. And they came to Penn and CHOP. Carl June had gotten approval for this experimental treatment. She is now, so that was 7 years ago. I tell my incoming freshmen, when you were in middle school, Emily Whitehead was going to die. She is now a cancer-free 14-year-old. And not only that, but there are thousands of people who are young children and adults alike who are benefiting from CAR T therapy and other kinds of genetic engineering. You can draw the line at not fooling around now with things that will be inherited because we don't know the effects of them, but somatic changes that save lives, it's just amazing. We now have, in the last 2 years, 8 FDA approvals that are bringing cancer patients into remission, and now we have, the New York Times did another thing for cardiac, for people who suffer from severe heart disease. The sky's the limit on this, so if it weren't for the positive effects, the mad scientists would win the day, but the positives are huge, and that's where bioethics really wants to run.
Andy, can we take a voice vote to see if we can extend this for 10 minutes?
We are a union shop.
All right, forget it.
And we like unions.
We respect the unions.
All right, before we open this to questions, I also want to say something that you said in the book that I think is very important. The applications of synthetic biology. There are many, obviously, but drug and vaccine development that is quicker and less costly and less dependent on scarce natural products. A plant extract that's the basis for treating malaria can be semi-synthesized, potentially providing reliable and affordable first-line treatment for a disease that kills 500,000 people, or algae and other microbes may be synthetically engineered to create more and efficient, cleaner burning fuels. So we have the mad scientist on one side, but these extraordinary possibilities on the other, and Amy Gutman is saying, let's put our investment into the possible advances and extraordinary opportunities that we have with synthetic biology.
When science partners with ethics, we can really run, and we can save lives, we can extend lives, and we can increase the quality of life. And that's really what we want everybody who reads this book to come away with, if only we can push forward in the ways that are really productive.
Let's get a couple of questions.
I have a question about your obligation as bioethicists to deal with the pharmaceutical industry. When I watch television, they're advertising cures for everything from bad breath to cancer. So my question is, what, and then I will go to the doctor and I'll tell the doctor that I want Skriaza, which is going to do something terrific. The doctor may say to me, well, where did you get that information? I got it on the internet, I got it on television. So I end up telling the doctor what they should be prescribing for me. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And if it's a bad thing, what are you doing about it?
Well, 22 years ago, a colleague, when I was at the University of Virginia, a physician came into me with a piece of paper and he said, a patient just handed me this. It was a printout from the web. And I think doctors are seeing, you know, more and more of this, and it's a huge problem. When I hate watching CNN at 6 o'clock, when I do watch CNN, because, among other things, because of these ads. But this is part of the more general problem we have in this country. Everybody's got their hand out, their palm up in our system. And it is unacceptable, and as I said before, unsustainable. It's in the interest, actually, of pharma and the private insurance industry to get ahead of this problem, because ultimately cost controls will be imposed. If they're not part of the solution, as you say, they will be part of the problem. I share your outrage.
There's a simple one big way. It's not simple. I mean, it's simply stated, but it really needs to happen in this country, and every other advanced democracy allows it. The biggest payer of healthcare costs, of pharma costs, the biggest payer by far is Medicare, is our government. And Medicare needs to be authorized to negotiate prices.
Another question? Right here.
Who is going to pay for research, given the fact that you're going to put cost controls in and destroy the profit motive?
Yeah, so we won't destroy the profit motive. Cost controls should be put in on the basis of cost effectiveness. So what we think would work, but again, it's up to the American people to decide this, but we are the only country among the advanced democracies that pays for research. The government pays for it. The government pays for a huge part of healthcare costs, and they do nothing. Medicare does nothing. It's not authorized to control costs based on effectiveness. So, what, for example, CAR T cell therapy is enormously expensive, and the prices will go down over time. By any measure of cost effectiveness, it's worth it. Opioids, which this year cost our society about $78 billion, are hugely overprescribed, and they do more harm than good. So if we have cost controls, that's why I say negotiated prices based on effectiveness, we can have the best of both worlds. We can have innovation, and we can also have affordability. Germany does it pretty darn well. It's a tiny society compared to ours, but it actually doesn't have a single payer system. It has many. It has private insurers. It funds a lot of research for its size. So if we actually can allow the government to negotiate prices, we can spur innovation on even more than we do now. The innovation machine in our society is slowing down because healthcare costs is verging on 20% of our GDP.
Marijuana has been legalized in 33 yes. states. No. It still doesn't have FDA approval. Why not? Medical marijuana.
Well, medical marijuana is a complicated case, but I think a less complicated case. And can I say, by the way, there's a longer conversation we have to have about your question. Pharma's not doing the innovation. It's the NIH that's doing the innovation. They don't even advertise themselves, pharma anymore, as being innovators. But we can talk more about this, because they're basically doing Me Too stuff. And I talked to a lot of people in pharma, so I know something about that. So the marijuana, it's complicated. But it really, in psychiatry, where the well has
but
pretty
well... But if you take some marijuana, it'll be less complicated. Well, it'll just feel, you'll sort of mellow out.
Being on this book tour with Amy is like being on an acid trip in a good way. Psychiatric medication, their well has run dry. Pharma's pulled out. They don't know what to do. There's no future there for them. They can't see a way to make money in the next quarter. Really interesting going what's going on in psychedelics, which is so the stuff from mushrooms, psilocybin, very promising for death anxiety and cancer anxiety, MDMA, also a version of MDMA. So there are some other... The problem is there's no incentive to do that, right? Because it's out there already. The mushrooms are in the ground. So you actually have to have the NIH and its allied institutions in other countries do that work, which they are doing. A lot of going on in the UK.
One of the reasons Jim asked this, though, I think, is because a lot of people who are, you know, worried about government regulating prices don't realize how many restrictions our government places on innovation. So in the case of marijuana, it's hard to make this stuff up. Our government only allows one institution in the whole U.S. to produce research-quality marijuana. And that institution is the one you'd all choose, University of Mississippi.
Right. Ole Miss.
Isn't it also possible, though...
Can't make it up.
Amy, isn't it possible that... that the FDA is protecting Big Pharma because they're worried that medical marijuana may make all or a lot of drugs less desirable because medical marijuana is doing the trick?
I'm thinking of the original House of Cards where I feel like saying, you may think that, but I couldn't possibly comment. I don't know. That may be true. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't know.
All right. Do we have time? No, we don't. One more question. One more question.
Right in the middle.
You know, there are now. I have to say that there is stuff going on in FDA about vaping. Oh, what's the vaping? So why isn't the FDA doing anything about vaping? Why are you allowing our kids to use this stuff? Look, I don't pretend to be an expert on what's going on with vaping. There are some localities that have started to restrict access to flavored forms of vape tobacco, and I think we are seeing a reaction to it now. But FDA's jurisdiction is limited with respect to these kinds of consumer items.
Can we express our appreciation to Amy Gutman and Jonathan Marino?
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.